During his previous hunts, he had discovered that each night the buffalo herd left the fastness of the dense forest to drink at a waterhole a mile or so beyond the boundary hedge. He knew that if he crossed it before midnight, he might be able to catch them while they were still at the water. It was his best chance of being able to pick out a bull and make his stalk. From the hollow tree at the edge of the forest, he retrieved the bow that he had cut and carved from a branch of wild olive. Sukina had stolen the single iron arrowhead from the collection of weapons that Governor Kleinhans had assembled during his service in the Indies, which now hung on the walls of the residence. It was unlikely that it would be missed from among the dozens of swords, shields, and knives that made up the display. "I will return it to you," he promised Sukina. "I would not have you suffer if it should be missed." "Your need of it is greater than my risk," she told him, as she slipped the arrowhead, wrapped in a scrap of cloth, beneath the seat of the carriage. "I also had a father who was denied a decent burial." Abberly had fitted the arrowhead to a reed shaft and bound it in place with twine and pitch. He had fletched it with the molted feathers from the hunting falcons housed in the mews behind the stables. However, he did not have time to search for the insect grubs from which to brew poison for the barbs, and so he must rely on this single shaft flying true to the mark. Now, as Abberly hunted in the shadows, himself another silent gliding shadow, he found old forgotten skills returning to him, and recalled the instruction that he had undergone as a young boy from the elders of his tribe. He felt the night wind softly caress his bare chest and flanks, and was aware of its direction at all times as he circled the waterhole until it blew straight into his face. It brought down to him the rich bovine stench of the prey he sought. The wind was strong enough to shake the tall reeds and cover any sound he might make, so he could move in swiftly over the last 100 paces. Above the soughing of the north wind and the rustle of the reeds, he heard a coughing grunt. He froze and knocked his single arrow. Had the lions come to the water ahead of the herd, he wondered, for that had been a leonine sound. He stared ahead and heard the sound of great hoofs plodding and sucking in the mud of the waterhole. Above the rippling heads of the reeds, a dark shape moved, mountainous in the moonlight. "A bull," he breathed. "A bull of a bull." The bull had finished drinking. The crafty old beast had come ahead of the cows and calves of the breeding herd. His back was coated with glistening wet mud from the wallow, and he plodded towards where Abberly crouched, his hoofs squelching in the mud. Abberly lost sight of the prey as he sank down among the swaying stems and let him come on, but he could mark him by the sound of the heavy breathing and by the rasping of the reeds dragging down his flanks. The bull was very close, but still out of Abberly's sight, when suddenly he shook his head as the reed stems tangled in his horns and his ears flapped against his cheeks. "If I reach out now, I could touch his snout," Abberly thought. Every nerve in his body was drawn as tight as the bowstring in his fingers. The reed bank parted in front of Abberly, and the massive head came through, the moonlight gleaming on the curved bosses of the horns. Abruptly, the bull became aware of something amiss, of danger lurking close at hand, and he stopped and raised his huge black head. As he lifted his muzzle to test the air, his nose was wet and shining, and water drooled from his mouth. He flared his nostrils into dark pits and snuffled the air. Abberly could feel his breath hot upon his naked chest and his face. The bull turned his head, questing for the scent of man or cat, for the hidden hunter. Abberly stayed still as a tree stump. He was holding the heavy bow at full draw. The power of the olive branch and the gut bowstring was so fierce that even the granite muscles in his arms and shoulder bulged and trembled with the effort. As the bull turned his head, he revealed the notch behind his ear, where the neck fused with the bone of his skull and the massive boss of his horns. Abberly held his aim for one heartbeat longer, then loosed the arrow. It flashed and whirred in the moonlight, leaping from his hand and burying half its length in the massive black neck. The bull reeled back. If the arrowhead had found the gap between the vertebrae of the spine, as Abberly had hoped, he would have dropped where he stood, but the iron point struck the spine and was deflected by the bone. It glanced aside, but sliced through the great artery behind the jawbone. As the bull bucked and kicked to the stinging impact of the steel, the severed artery erupted and a spout of blood flew high in the air, black as an ostrich feather in the light of the moon. The bull dashed past Abelly, hooking wildly with those wide curved horns. If Abelly had not dropped his bow and hurled himself aside, the burnished point that hissed by, a finger's width from his navel, would have skewered him and ripped open his bowels. The bull charged on and reached the hard, dry ground. On his knees, Abelly strained his ears to follow his quarry's crashing rush through the scrub. Abruptly, it came up short. There was a long, fraught pause in which he could hear the animal's laboured breathing and the patter of streaming blood falling on the leaves of the low bushes around it. Then he heard the bull stagger and stumble backwards, trying to remain on his feet while the strength flowed out of his huge body on that tide of dark blood. The beast fell heavily, so that the earth trembled under Abelly's bare feet. A moment later came the rasping death bellow, and thereafter an aching quietness. Even the night birds and the bullfrogs of the swamp had been silenced by that dreadful sound. It was as though all the forest held its breath at the passing of such a mighty creature. Then, slowly, the night came alive once again. The frogs piped and croaked from the reed beds, a nightjar screeched, and from afar an eagle owl hooted mournfully. Abelly skinned the bull with the knife that Tsukina had stolen for him from the residents' kitchens. He folded the green skin and tied it with bark rope. It was heavy enough to tax even his strength. He staggered with the bundle until he could get under it and balance it on his head. He left the naked carcass for the packs of night-prowling hyena and the flocks of vultures, carnivorous storks, kites and crows that would find it with the first light of morning, and set off back towards the colony and the tabletop mountain silhouetted against the stars. Even under his burden he moved at the ground-eating trot of the warriors of his tribe that was becoming so natural to him again after his confinement for 2 decades in a small ship upon the seas. He was remembering so much long-forgotten tribal lore and wisdom, relearning old skills, becoming once more a true son of this baked African earth. He climbed to the lower slopes of the mountain and left the bundled skin in a narrow crevice in the rock cliff. He covered it with large boulders, for the hyenas roamed here also, attracted by the rubbish and wastes and sewage generated by the human settlement of the colony. When he had placed the last boulder, he looked up at the sky and saw that the curling scorpion was falling fast towards the dark horizon. Only then he realized how swiftly the night had sped and went bounding back across the slope. He reached the edge of the company gardens just as the first rooster crowed in the darkness. Later that morning, as he waited on the bench with the other slaves outside the kitchens for his breakfast bowl of gruel and thick curdled sour milk, Tsukina passed on her way to tend the affairs of the household. "I heard you return last night. You were out too late," she whispered, without turning her head on the orchid stem of her neck. "If you are discovered, you will bring great hardship on all of us, and our plans will come to naught." "My task is almost finished," he rumbled softly. "Tonight will be the last time I need to go out." "Have a care, Abelly. There is much at risk," she said, and glided away. Despite her warning, she had given him any help he had asked for, and without watching her go, Abelly whispered to himself, "That little one has the heart of a lioness." That night, when the house had settled down for the night, he slipped through the grating. Again the dogs were stilled by his quiet whistle, and he had lumps of dried sausage for each of them. When he reached the wall below the lawns, he looked to the stars and saw in the eastern sky the first soft luminescence of the moonrise. He vaulted over it, and keeping well clear of the road, guided himself by touch along the outside of the wall towards the settlement. No more than 3 or 4 dim lights were showing from the cottages and buildings of the village. The 4 ships at anchor in the bay were all burning lanterns at their mastheads. The castle was a dark, brooding shape against the starlight. He waited at the edge of the parade and tuned his ears to the sounds of the night. Once, as he was about to set out across the open ground, he heard drunken laughter and snatches of singing, as a party of soldiers from the castle returned from an evening of debauchery among the rude hovels on the waterfront, which passed as taverns in this remote station. selling the rough, raw spirit the Hottentots called dop. One of the revellers carried a tar-dipped torch. The flames wove uncertainly as the man stopped before the gibbet in the middle of the parade and shouted an insult at the corpse that still hung upon it. His companions bellowed with drunken laughter at his humour and then reeled on, supporting each other towards the castle. When they had disappeared through the gates, and when silence and darkness fell, Abberley moved out swiftly across the parade. Though he could not see more than a few paces ahead, the smell of corruption guided him. Only a dead lion smells as strongly as a rotting human corpse. Sir Francis Courtenay's body had been beheaded and neatly quartered. Stadacher Jan had used a butcher's cleaver to hack through the larger bones. Abberley brought down the head from the spike on which it had been impaled. He wrapped it in a clean white cloth and placed it in the saddlebag he carried. Then he retrieved the other parts of the corpse. The dogs from the village had carried off some of the smaller bones. But even working in darkness, Abberley was able to recover what remained. He closed and buckled the leather flap of the bag, slung it over his shoulder, and set off again at a run towards the mountain. Sukina knew the mountain intimately, every ravine, cliff, and crag. She had explained to him how to find the narrow, concealed entrance to the cavern, where the previous night he had left the raw buffalo skin. In the light of the rising moon, he returned unerringly to it. When he reached the entrance, he stooped and swiftly removed the boulders that covered the buffalo skin. Then he crawled further into the crevice and drew aside the bushes that hung down from the cliff above to conceal the dark throat of the cavern. He worked deftly with flint and steel to light one of the candles Sukina had provided. Shielding the flame with cupped hands from any watcher below the mountain, he went forward and crawled into the low natural tunnel on hands and knees, dragging the saddlebag behind him. As Sukina had told him, the tunnel opened suddenly into a cavern high enough for him to stand. He held the candle above his head and saw that the cavern would make a fitting burial place for a great chief. There was even a natural rock shelf at the far end. He left the saddlebag upon it and crawled back to retrieve the buffalo skin. Before he entered the tunnel again, he looked back over his shoulder and reoriented himself in the direction of the moonrise. "I shall turn his face to greet 10,000 moons and all the sunrises of eternity," he said softly, and dragged the heavy skin into the cavern and spread it on the rock floor. He placed the candle on the rock shelf and began to unpack the bag. First, he set aside those small offerings and ceremonial items he had brought with him. Then he lifted out Sir Francis's covered head and laid it in the centre of the buffalo hide. He unwrapped it reverently and showed no repugnance for the thick, cloying odour of decay that slowly filled the cavern. He assembled all the other dismembered parts of the body and arranged them in their natural order, binding them in place with slim strands of bark rope, until Sir Francis lay on his side, his knees drawn up beneath his chin and his arms hugging his legs, the fetal position of the womb and of sleep. Then he folded the wet buffalo hide tightly around him, so that only his ravaged face was still exposed. He stitched the folds of the hide around him, so that they would dry into an iron-hard sarcophagus. It was a long and meticulous task, and when the candle burnt down and guttered in a pool of its own liquid wax, he lit another from the stump and worked on. When he had finished, he took up the turtle-shell comb, another of Sukina's gifts, and combed out the tangled tresses that still adhered to Sir Francis's skull and braided them neatly. At last he lifted the seated body and placed it on the stone shelf. He turned it carefully to face the east, to gaze forever towards the moonrise and the dawn. For a long while he squatted below the ledge and looked upon the ravaged head, seeing it in his mind's eye as it once was, the face of the vigorous young mariner who had rescued him from the slaver's hold 2 decades before. At last he rose and began to gather up the grave goods he had brought with him. He laid them one at a time on the ledge before the body of Sir Francis. The tiny model of a ship he had carved with his own hands. There had not been time to lavish care upon its construction, and it was crude and childlike. However, the 3 masts had sails set upon them, and the name carved into the stern was Lady Edwina. May this ship carry you over the dark oceans to the landfall where the woman whose name she bears awaits you, Abberley whispered. Next, he placed the knife and the bow of olive wood beside the ship. I have no sword with which to arm you, but may these weapons be your defense in the dark places. Then he offered the food bowl and the water bottle. May you never again hunger or thirst. Lastly, the cross of wood that Abberley had fashioned and decorated with green abalone shell, white carved bone, and small bright stones from the riverbed. May the cross of your God, which guided you in life, guide you still in death, he said, as he placed the cross before Sir Francis's empty eyes. Kneeling on the cavern floor, he built a small fire and lit it from the candle. May this fire warm you in the darkness of your long night. Then, in his own language, he sang the funeral chant and the song of the traveller on a long journey, clapping his hands softly to keep time and to show respect. When the flames of the fire burned low, he stood and moved to the entrance of the cavern. Farewell, my friend, he said. Goodbye, my father. Governor van der Velde was a cautious man. At first, he had not allowed Abberley to drive him in the carriage. This is a whim of yours that I will not deny, my dear, he told his wife. But the fellow is a black savage. What does he know of horses? He is really very good, better by far than old Fredericus, Katinka laughed. And he looks so splendid in the new livery I have designed for him. His fancy maroon coat and breeches will be of little interest to me when he breaks my neck, Van der Velde said. But despite his misgivings, he watched the way Abberley handled the team of greys. The first morning that Abberley drove the governor down from the residence to his suite in the castle, there was a stir and a murmur among the convicts working on the walls as the carriage crossed the parade and approached the castle gates. They had recognized Abberley sitting high on the coachman's seat with the long whip in his white-gloved hands. Howell was on the point of shouting a greeting to him, but checked himself in time. It was not the sting of Bernard's whip that dissuaded him, but he realized that it would be unwise to remind his captors that Abberley had been his shipmate. The Dutch would expect him to regard a black man as a slave and not as a companion. "Nobody greet Abberley," he whispered urgently to Daniel, sweating beside him. "Ignore him. Pass it on." The order went swiftly down the ranks of men on the scaffold and then to those labouring in the courtyard. When the carriage came in through the gates to a turnout of the honour guard and the salutes of the garrison's officers, none of the convicts paid any attention. They devoted themselves to the heavy work with block and tackle and iron bar. Abberley sat like a carved figurehead on the coachman's seat, staring directly ahead. His dark eyes did not even flicker in Hal's direction. He drew the team of greys to a halt at the foot of the staircase and sprang down to lower the folding steps and hand out the governor. Once Van der Velde had waddled up the stairs and disappeared into his suite, Abberley returned to his seat and sat upon it, unmoving, facing straight ahead. In a short time the jailers and guards forgot his silent presence, turned their attention to their duties, and the castle fell into its routine. An hour passed, and one of the horses threw its head and fidgeted. From the corner of his eye, Hal had noticed Abberley touch the reins to agitate the animal slightly. Now he climbed unhurriedly down and went to its head. He held its leather cheek strap and stroked its head and murmured endearments to it. The grey quietened immediately under his touch, and Abberley went down on one knee and lifted first one front foot and then the other, examining the hoofs for any injury. Still on one knee, and screened by the horse's body from the view of any of the guards or overseers, he looked up for the first time at Hal. Their gaze touched for an instant. Abberley nodded almost imperceptibly and opened his right fist to give Hal a glimpse of the tiny curl of white paper he had in his palm, then closed his fist and stood up. He walked down the team of horses, examining each animal and making minute adjustments to the harness. At last he turned aside and leaned against the stone wall beside him, stooping to wipe the fine flowering of dust from his boots. Hal watched him take the quill of paper and surreptitiously stuff it into a joint in the stonework of the wall. He straightened and returned to the coachman's seat to await the governor's pleasure. Van der Velde never showed consideration for servant, slave, or animal. All that morning the team of greys stood patiently in the traces, with Aberley soothing them at intervals. A little before noon the governor re-emerged from the company offices and had himself driven back to the residence for the midday meal. In the dusk, as the convicts warily climbed down into the courtyard, Hal stumbled as he reached the ground and put out his hand to steady himself. Neatly he picked the scrap of folded paper from the joint in the stonework where Aberley had left it. Once in the dungeon, there was just sufficient light filtering down from the torch in its bracket at the top of the staircase for Hal to read the message. It was written in a fine, neat hand that he did not recognize. Despite all his father's and Hal's own instruction, Aberley's handwriting had never been better than large, sprawling, and malformed. It seemed that another scribe had framed these words. A tiny nub of charcoal was wrapped in the paper, placed there for Hal to write his reply on the reverse of the scrap. "The captain buried with honour." Hal's heart leapt as he read that. So it was Aberley who had taken down his father's mutilated corpse from the gibbet. I should have known he would give my father that respect.